tonight on Arena. We explore the enduring appeal of Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca and Dermot Bulger on his Secrets Never Told. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Rebecca is probably the best known and most successful of all of the novels of Daphne du Maurier. The story is set in a house called Mandalay, owned by wealthy widower Maxim de Winter. There, his deceased wife, Rebecca, still commands a mysterious presence, increasingly felt by his new, nervous, young, unnamed bride. The novel Rebecca has never gone out of print since its first publication in 1938. It was adapted into a stage play by the author herself in 1940, and in 1940 again into a movie directed by Alfred Hitchcock. This week, Netflix has released a brand new screen version of Rebecca, which we will be reviewing on tomorrow's show. But joining me now to speak about the novel, about Daphne du Maurier, and the checkered history of Rebecca is Edel Coffey. Edel, Rebecca was published, as I said, in 1938. It was her fifth novel, but it wasn't at all well received by the critics. Why was that?
No, it wasn't. And I think a lot of it was to do with snobbery and also how that kind of gothic fiction was viewed at that time. It was an absolute bestseller with readers all over the world, both in the UK and in America. But it was described and dismissed very quickly by critics as a novelette, as a romantic fiction, as women's fiction. And it was just seen as a story for women. But when you look at the novel itself, it is extraordinary that it was dismissed in that way, because it is such an incredible novel. It is completely unique and it is so disturbing and atmospheric.
So I just gave a little presse of the novel there, but remind us a little more of the plot of Rebecca.
Yes. As you mentioned there, it's, well, first of all, it's got one of the most well-known opening lines of any book in literature. Last night I dreamt I went to Mandalay again. And Mandalay has to be described as one of the characters in the book. It is the big house where Maxim de Winter lives. Maxim de Winter is in Monte Carlo at the opening of this book, in Monte Carlo, I should say, at the opening of this book. And there he meets this young, unnamed woman. She's only ever known in the book as Mrs. de Winter, which is seen as a reference to the fact that she subsumes herself completely for this man. She's a young companion, a paid companion to a wealthy American woman. And she meets Maxim de Winter and they start to spend some time together. And within a matter of weeks, it seems, he has proposed to her and he asks her to come back to Mandalay with him. Now, this is all set in South of France. It's all beautiful. It's a honeymoon period. And then
And she is hearing, even in the South of France, she is hearing that his previous wife, Rebecca, was the most beautiful woman anybody had seen. So she's fairly intimidated even before she arrives in Cornwall.
Listen, Kay, it's your basic nightmare as the new girlfriend. It's like she was beautiful. She was the love of his life. She was so elegant. She had great style. She could sail. This woman could do everything. And so she's racked with intimidation by the time she gets to Mandalay. And it doesn't help that when she gets there, she meets Mrs. Danvers, who is the housekeeper. And Mrs. Danvers' relationship with Rebecca goes back years. Like, she came to Mandalay with Rebecca when Rebecca married Mr. de Winter. And she has what can only be described as an obsessive love for her. We don't really know much about their relationship, but it does always strike you in the book and in all the films that we've seen as just slightly too close.
Yes, she may in fact be in love with Rebecca.
Exactly. And they may have had a sexual relationship, and de Maurier always leaves that kind of open to interpretation.
Now, we have a clip. This is from later on in the book and the film. It's Mrs. de Winter, who Joan Fontaine played in the Alfred Hitchcock version. And it's after a costume party that went incredibly wrong due to Mrs. Danvers setting up this Mrs. de Winter. So Mrs. de Winter runs upstairs and runs into Rebecca's old bedroom, which she shared with her husband, obviously. And she finds Mrs. Danvers there, who is going, of course, not to console her.
You wouldn't think she'd been gone so long, would you? Sometimes when I walk along the corridor, I fancy I hear her just behind me. That quick, light step. I couldn't mistake it anywhere. It's not only in this room. It's in all the rooms in the house. I can almost hear it now. Do you think the dead come back and watch the living?
I don't believe it.
Sometimes. I wonder if she doesn't come back here to Manderley. Watch you and Mr. De Winter together. You look tired. Why don't you stay here a while and rest? And listen to the sea. So soothing. Listen to it. Listen. Listen to the sea.
Creepy. Judith Anderson there as Mrs. Danvers and Joan Fontaine as Mrs. De Winter from Rebecca from the 1940 version made by Alfred Hitchcock. So Rebecca was written at a difficult time in the life of Daphne du Maurier.
Yes.
Was there things in her life then that might have influenced the story?
Yeah, I fully believe so. She had gone to Cairo with her husband, who was in the army, and he was posted there, and she had joined him there, and that was the first time she'd ever gone on a posting with him. She was pregnant with her second daughter, and her time in Cairo, she hated it there, first of all, but she was expected to be an army wife in the way that she hadn't been when she was at home. So she was hosting dinners and had to attend dinners hosted by other army wives as well. And it wasn't really her thing. And also it was taking her away from her writing. And she tore up the first 10,000 words, her first attempt at writing Rebecca. And she hadn't ever done that before with a novel. So it was very difficult. But she started again while she was still in Cairo, and she finished it when she returned to Cornwall, to her version of Manderley, which was called Mena Billy. Now, she sent it to her publisher and sent it with a note kind of saying, look, it's a bit grim, it's a bit depressing, I don't know about it. And he wrote back and said, it is the most exquisite romance story, and it's definitely going to be a bestseller. And it was. He was right. But the notion that it's the most exquisite love story or romance story is just, it's baffling to me anyway, but you can see how it might be sold as that. But there's so many things wrong with that description in terms of romance and the idea of romance. Now, we find out why Rebecca was killed or died, and I'm not sure if we should go into that or not, because some people won't have seen the Netflix
Maybe not,
adaptation.
Especially with the new Netflix coming
exactly.
up.
Exactly. Yeah. So it is a mystery. It is there's lots of aspects around that don't really fall into the romance category for me, and obviously didn't for Daphne du Maurier, and she took great exception to being described as that.
Yes, because Maxim de Winter is a very interesting character, isn't he? I mean, he's very attentive to Mrs. de Winter when he meets her as a young woman in Monte Carlo. But then he becomes more distant and a little bit abrasive towards her when they're in Manderley.
Yes, it's a familiar trajectory of a lot of relationships, Kay. But yeah, he does. And, you know, the whole time she's haunted by this idea of this perfect wife before her and this beautiful woman. And so she puts it down to that. She thinks, oh, he loved her so much and he can never love me that much. And she was so accomplished and I'm just... And of course, it doesn't help that she comes from a different class than Rebecca and she feels so inferior. And but he's a mysterious sort of brooding type. And that's also a throwback to Jane Eyre, which this book is indebted to in many ways. It's part of the Gothic tradition. You know, there was the big house, there's a big fire in the big house, there's a brooding
man. The first wife in the attic.
Exactly. So there's all those things, and they are tropes and part of the tradition of Gothic novels. But also, he's an interesting character, and I think Daphne du Maurier wants to use him as the sort of the centre point or the fulcrum on which she hangs her different female characters to dance around him. He is just, he's a very typical man of the time. He's privileged, he is rich, and he has that sort of sense of entitlement. You know, he's off being busy and he leaves her alone for long stretches of time because he is doing important things with his time. And, you know, that leaves her alone to kind of wander into Rebecca's room, to find all of her stuff, to find all the evidence of her accomplishments and to feel even worse about herself.
Again, as the story goes on, then we learn more about Rebecca, that she herself was a woman of the world.
That's a nice way of putting it. Yes.
And how does this reflect this other woman, this first wife? How does that reflect some of Daphne du Maurier's own life? Because she too was very sexually experienced, quite open sexually.
Yeah, I think this book is representative of the huge struggle she had herself between being a wife to a very honourable and honoured army man, and also being that individual creative type who was incredibly successful in her own right and obviously had huge creative impulses and urges to write. And I think in that time it must have been very difficult for her to find that time or to demand that time or to justify taking that time away from her family, away from her husband. And I think that's what both of those women represent in the book. You know, you've got Mrs. De Winter, who is, we never find out her name. She's our narrator and we don't know her name. We just know that she's Mrs. De Winter. And she's there as the kind of very accepting, very subsumed, very demure wife that du Maurier obviously thinks is the sort of exemplary wife of the time. And then there's Rebecca, who is this uncontrollable, wild woman who may have been bisexual, who was having affairs, who was beautiful, who was a socialite, who was accomplished. And she kind of has this, there's a sense when you're reading the book of her as almost like an actual sort of spirit of the sea, not a human in that way. And it's that representation of women's sexuality as a scary thing or a thing to be afraid of.
And let's hear one of the clips we have of Daphne du Maurier. Here she's talking about the book The Loving Spirit, but in the clip it's from a television show called The Make-Believe World of Daphne du Maurier. She's interviewed by a guy called Cliff Micklemore. But here she talks about the first novel, but she talks about that need of being independent.
How much advance did you get from the publisher?
I think I had, for Loving Spirit, I wouldn't swear to it, but I would think it was about £75 advance.
Was that a lot or a little?
It seemed a hell of a lot to me, yes. And it was quite good in those days.
Could novelists make money in those days?
Well, bit by bit. I can't remember how well the Loving Spirit sold, but obviously from that time on I began to get a little bit independent. You see, and so could more or less come down to four, do what I liked and pay for myself, which was my main object always.
Because you go on about this, about the driving forces. I must make money, you say.
Yes, yes. I mean, the driving force was I must write, get this story out of my system. But following closely upon that, I must be independent. I always wanted to be independent. And not from any antagonism to the family, but simply so that they didn't have to pay for my wishes, whims or whatever.
Daphne du Maurier there from 1977. So, yes, she was a woman trying, in a very conservative world, trying to make her own independent pathway.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think a really interesting sentence in that clip there was where she said, where I can come down to Fowey, which was where her home was in Cornwall, and do what I like. I think there was an absolute desire to be her own agent, to do what she wanted to do without any of those. Like, she's probably a woman who should never have been, should never have gotten married, because the only expectation on her from her family in her biographies is that she would make a good marriage, and she did. But it sounds like after the war, when her husband came home from the Second World War, the marriage seemed to have been over. And after that, they both had affairs, and he had a drinking problem. But it does seem like she might have been a much happier person. And I'm really surmising here, but she might have been a much more satisfied person, just living independently and doing what she liked.
We'll go on to talk about some of the adaptations now, but maybe we'll just listen to Daphne du Maurier talking on Desert Island Discs. This is, again, from 1977. Here she's talking to Roy Plumley, and he asks her about the screen adaptations of her work.
You've been rather fortunate in the number of your stories which have been picked up by the film industry.
Not a tremendous number, really, you know. Rebecca, Frenchman's Creek, My Cousin Rachel, The Birds.
That was from
Hitchcock,
a short story.
Yes. And The Scapegoat with Alec Guinness.
Yes.
Don't Look Now is another short story. That's about... Hungry Hill was another one, All About Ireland.
That's rather an impressive total.
It's only about 6 or 7 out of about 20.
Yes.
Well, pretty good, yes.
Hitchcock made a couple of them.
I think he did Rebecca and The Birds.
Which ones have you liked most?
I would think Rebecca. Yes, I think that was... very good.
That was Laurence
Olivier,
wasn't it?
Yes, Laurence Olivier and Joan Fontaine. I would say that was definitely the best.
Daphne du Maurier from Desert Island Discs. I mean, she was very well served by her film adapters, wasn't she?
She was, even though she gives him scant praise for it there, where she says, I think Hitchcock did The Birds and Rebecca. But she really was. I mean, in 1940, he won the best film Oscar for Rebecca, and it really... it must have been such a dramatic film, considering the psychological atmosphere of terror and that kind of haunting. It's very unsettling. It's very unseemly.
She wasn't happy with The Birds. She wasn't, because she saw it as an environmental tale, whereas he saw it as kind of a moral tale about sexual promiscuity, wasn't it?
Yeah, he changed it. And also he moved it from Cornwall, which she didn't like. But she did like Rebecca. He changed Rebecca too, but that was to do with the censors. But it's interesting that the new Rebecca as well has also been slightly changed from the book version in terms of the ending. And I find it really interesting that none of the male directors who have adapted her films have been able to stick to exactly her story as it's written in the book, which is part of the reason why none of these adaptations get exactly to be as completely intoxicating as the book is. But also it's interesting, I think, is there a reason why they can't accept her version, which is quite dark? Or is it just entertainment values? And it's like, look, everybody likes a happy ending in a film, so let's go with this ending.
So I know you've seen the new film version, and as I say, we're going to review it tomorrow. Is it worth seeing?
It's definitely worth seeing because, first of all, in these very bleak times, the first half hour of the film is an absolute holiday for the mind because it's in the sumptuous, beautiful, most beautiful hotel. It's supposed to be set in South France. There's all this sunshine. There's a little bit of nudity on the beach and the sand is on her skin and you can nearly
taste... Lily James plays
Mrs. De Winter. And you can nearly taste your summer holiday of years ago, okay? So for a little bit of light relief, it's worth it for that. But also, it is kind of gorgeous. It's beautiful to look at. It's like Downton Abbey. But it's just, despite everything that they've thrown at it, all the gothic sort of tropes are there, it lacks the emotional impact of the novel. Like, I would recommend the novel heartily to anybody, but yeah,
and can you read the novel now without imagining Laurence Olivier or now Armie Hammer as Maxim?
Well, I think I'd prefer to imagine Armie Hammer as Maxim now every time I read the book because he's absolutely beautiful in the film. But I can actually read the book. You see, I read the book before I had seen any film adaptation. I think once you've done that, you always visualise
your own
image.
You had your own private Maxim.
But he is perfect in that role. He's perfect. Really, people will remember him as the Winklevoss twins from that social network film years ago. So that's who's in the Maxim De Winter role. So
Yes. Okay, well, we'll see what our critics think tomorrow night. Adele Coffey, thank you very much for speaking to me about Daphne du Maurier and the lasting appeal of the 1938 novel Rebecca. The new screen version of Rebecca is out now on Netflix, and as I said, we'll be reviewing it on tomorrow's show. Secrets Never Told is the first short story collection by Dermot Bulger, a writer so prolific in poetry, plays, novels, it's hard to believe he could have a debut to make at this stage. Not only that, one of the stories, Supermarket Flowers, has just been shortlisted for the Short Story of the Year in the 2020 Unpussed Irish Book Awards. And Dermot Bulger joins me now. Congratulations on that.
Indeed, it's actually wonderful to be, a debutante at the age of 61 and three quarters. And it's also great to be on a shortlist with Jackie McCarrick and Kit DeVal and Carolyn Hughes and Louise Kendi and Billy O'Callaghan, who are great writers. So I'm in very good company there.
Yes, it'll be very exciting to see who wins. So it's 44 years since you wrote your first short story.
I still remember going out to the in Finglas to the local grocery shop and getting a copy of New Irish Writing with David Marcus. I was a schoolboy in Malevin College.
This was in the Irish Press.
In the Irish Press, yeah. And it's funny, I've been involved in with Kieran Carty in resurrecting it in the Irish Independent in its latest home. It has never gone away, that page. And to see my words there on the page, I never imagined that it would take 44 years to get around to actually writing a full collection of stories. But I'm a storyteller, and some stories come to you and you just know it's a big story, it's a novel. And then sometimes you know it's going to be one day, it's a play. And these were like in-between stories that haunted me for years that never found a... And they became short stories on BBC Radio or RTÜ Radio or Anthology or anything else. But when you write those short stories, they're always to a very specific length. And during when lockdown came, artists can have retrospectives and musicians, writers don't. So I just said, I'm coming to an age, I don't want my sons have put this book together. And during lockdown, I sat down and I let these characters speak to me at their own length. And so I wrote these versions for myself. So it's lovely that it's out there and that people are enjoying it.
And what years do these cover? Are there some new stories? I know, as you say, you've changed some of them, but do they span your career while you were writing other things?
They're all new. Like, it's funny, the first story is about a writer at his book launch and somebody turns up who's the last person he wants to see. It was a story where that came to me when I was staying, spent one night in a flat in London, borrowed by somebody in 1986. And I said, this would be amazing there for a story. And I never got to write it. And then the BBC asked me for a story 10 years ago and I wrote it. It came back to me. And now I've rewrote it properly. So they actually sort of, they're all written this year. And yet sometimes they come into your head and they won't go away. So sometimes it's 40 years waiting. It's amazing when you sat down to write them. They actually came back to me fresh.
Of course, we as people who don't write love reading stories about the writing profession. Tell us a little bit about that one. About
it was very interesting. There are sort of writers who are geniuses and they're so consumed by their own genius they never get around to writing. And then there are writers that are dog's bodies like myself who just care, just do nothing else. And so it is about two friends and one is fossilised in his genius and has wonderful ideas but has no ability to actually, it's almost like paralysed by terror of his own greatness to write them. And somebody, one of his friends borrows an idea just to use to get started and that idea takes off, and so he's living a lie for 30 years of his life. And the literary life is a strange life. I've never really written about it, but I did it in two stories in this book because I'll never write a memoir. I think John McGowan's only mistake was that memoir, which is a beautifully written memoir, but I think it's nice to keep the mystique around them. So there's bits of my life threaded through all these stories, and then there's bits of total wild fantasy.
Yes, because it is about that idea, the last person, this story. It's about, like, Jack, who's, it's not just, you know, inspiration versus perspiration. It's just that Jack does keep on going. He makes a writer's life for himself. Whereas Killian was a bit, he was gifted, but he was a bit of a dilettante.
And we also know those dilettantes, that sort of who actually, and I remember as a child, not as as a teenager, meeting these people and being intimidated and terrified by them. And there's a second story called Arrivals in the book, which is about a writer who's been away from Ireland for 30 years and comes back, and he's asked to go to a hospice to visit a dying man who is convinced that they've spent their entire life locked in literary rivalry, and he has no recollection. Eventually he realises he met him when he was 17 once in a pub in Finglas, but he's gone off and led this life where this man has actually held on to this notion that there's this great rivalry between them. As I've got to an age in life where I meet people and people tell me stories about myself that I have no recollection of whatsoever, and it's about that thing of encountering your past but realise that this is somebody's distorted version of your own past.
Yes, because when you're a young writer or an aspiring writer, you're having all those conversations, or a filmmaker or anybody the creative industries, aren't you? And you're discussing ideas, and you're half the time there may be pastiches of something that's out there already, but you're full of passion about them, and I suppose some people hang on to that without becoming the artist they aspire to be.
Well, so a lot of people, I also, they don't really understand how the creative process works in terms of how books are edited, how plays are done, and they keep this very innocent version of the whole process. And they also, writers are great prevaricators, and they put all these roadblocks in their mind to actually go on and doing things. But that's only two of the stories about writers, because I don't like writing much about writers, but I love writing for women. And
yes, let's talk about the one that's been shortlisted, which is Supermarket Flowers. And that is a story, a very tragic story. And it's about two women. Tell me about the two women in
it. Well, again, this is something that I was inspired by driving in the west of Ireland and seeing at the corner of a housing estate in the edge of a small town, there was a wall, and there was a plaque on the wall with a picture of a child who was knocked down there, and wondering who actually owned that space, and if the person really wanted that plaque on the wall or didn't, or were they, And so it's about a woman who has lost her husband. She's minding her two grandchildren like so many grandmothers are. She's very, very patient, very, very kind. She does her best for everybody. There's a crash outside her house, and a child is killed when a tourist loses control of a car and smashes. And the young mother becomes obsessed with this place, and she comes and she brings flowers, and we all see those shrines of flowers, and then the flowers become candles, and then she's there every night, and becomes this emotional tug of war as to who actually owns the footpath outside this house. She wants the wall rebuilt, and she wants a child's plaque in the wall, and this woman is very, very sympathetic for a long time, but in the end just wants her life back, wants her space back, wants her footpath back. And this woman is taken for granted by her own daughter, and the young mother who's consumed in her grief has no relationship with her mother, and they become mother and daughter as they fight this battle, this emotional battle. They're both coping with grief in their own way, one by retreating into their house and one by needing this public display to go on. I just found that sometimes you're driving by a place or you see a small incident and it stays with you for years and years later, it becomes a story, and that's what I love about writing the process.
Another story that I love from the collection is The Lover, which is really based on that in 1965 when they brought the remains of Roger Casement back to Ireland for internment here. And you decided to use that event as a way of exploring his homosexuality and the life he must have lived in Ireland. We think of that in association to his time in Africa, for example.
But I wanted to actually, I was very moved by Case. I remember as a child hearing the 21 gun salute or whatever, and when gun salute in Finglas had travelled, and my father's name was William, but he was called Roger all his life after Roger Casement. And when they exhumed his body, there was so little left. There was just a few ribs and a bit of the skull and everything else. And there's a man standing out in that crowd outside Glasdevin Cemetery who was a lover of Roger Casement. And he's remembering this other Casement that none of these people know or want to know, because there's never been any great clamour to bring the diaries back to Ireland. There's always been clamour to bring the body back. And he realises that although Casement was a great enthusiast and was a great passionate and great humanist and did amazing work in the Congo and amazing work in the Amazon jungles and really fought for justice, whatever version of Ireland he was trying to create would have no room for Roger Casement, would have no room for him and for all of those anonymous gay men who died in the 20s and 40s and 50s and 60s. And for him watching this coffin and knowing it contained so little of Caitlin's body, it's as if this state funeral allows space for all of these silent, unknown people, in the same way as a part of Caitlin's life was unknown, to actually find their place. So it was, again, a strange story that I wrote around 25 years ago and never really published, because I would sooner have my kneecaps destroyed by golf than anything else.
And now that you have published this first collection of short stories, presumably you write short stories all the time, or are you working on something else now and you'll just keep an eye on the short story?
Well, in some ways, I just wanted to wrap up. You come to a time in life and you want to wrap up your life. I'm not dying or anything, but simply you want to make sense of your life. And I said, I don't want my sons to be rooting around through boxes and boxes of papers trying to find these stories. So it was a chance to put those stories to bed. I mean, I'm not as late as John Sheen, my friend, the musician who published his first collection of poems on the Great Collection when he was around 75 years of age, as I always like him. So I'm only 61 and three quarters, so I'm not that late coming to it. But it was just lovely as a chance to do this. And now I'm writing poems because this strange times of walking the streets at night and this lockdown that we're going into. And I think that you need to keep creativity alive, and you also need to keep small publishers alive, small Irish bookshops alive in this time. We need to keep ourselves alive and keep each other alive. And so I'm doing it by writing poems now and by hoping to encourage people to read books.
Exactly. Like Secrets Never Told, which is the new collection of short stories by Dermot Bulger, which is published by New Ireland. And the short story that's on the Unpus Book Awards is Supermarket Flowers. Dermot Bulger, thank you very much.
Okay.
The Undoing, a new six-part drama starring Hugh Grant and Nicole Kidman, premieres on Sky Atlantic next week. The series, which concerns a grisly murder case that destroys the lives of two Manhattan families. It's based on the international bestseller You Should Have Known by American author Jean Hanef Kurelich. And it reunites Kidman with Big Little Lies series creator and writer David E. Kelly. I thought it was a compelling watch because I watched all about four episodes of it last night. But Chris Wasser is going to join me now and he's going to see whether it is as compelling as Kelly's other series. Chris, The Undoing is a bit tricky when one has to come to discuss it because you don't really want to give any of the plot twists away. So what's the basic setup?
It is a bit tricky, Kay, and I sort of wish, you know, we could have time to discuss it before we went on air, because if you're unfamiliar with the novel and you're going into it fresh, that's probably better. But we can maybe go through the basic setup, which is, as you said, Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant star as a married couple living in Manhattan. She's Grace Fraser. She is a successful therapist, and he is Jonathan Fraser. He is an oncologist who works at a hospital nearby. And theirs is quite a happy life. You know, they're financially comfortable. They have a lovely apartment in the city. They also have a young teenage son, Henry, played by Noah Jupe, who viewers will know from the A Quiet Place films and also Le Mans 66. He's a wonderful young actor. And, you know, it's all quite idyllic. It's all, you know, wonderful life, lots of money, everything's grand. Until Grace is working on a fundraiser for her son's private school, and she meets with the other mums, you know, of the kids that Henry goes to school with, to discuss, you know, plans for this huge gala event. And it's there that she meets this new mother, Alina, played by Matilda De Argelis, a newcomer who I'd never seen before. And there's a weird connection between the two. You know, the other mothers don't really like Alina, but she's drawn to Grace, and you don't really know why. There's something, they have quite an uncomfortable relationship at first, but long story short, the fundraiser goes off and Alina's there, and she's quite upset at this fundraiser and she leaves early, and so too does Jonathan, because he's called away by the hospital. And you think, you know, it's just, you know, look, she's upset, I'll talk to her tomorrow, the husband has to work, she'll talk to him tomorrow. Unfortunately, when the next day comes about for Grace, everything changes. And all we can really say, Kay, is that someone goes missing and someone else is murdered. And as you said at the top there, the lives of the families of both Alina and Grace are completely turned upside down.
I suppose it's important to say that Alina is maybe younger than the other women. She's also a beautiful woman, a very sensuous woman. She's breastfeeding her new baby and she's very happy to walk around in the nude.
Yes, and this is something that, you know, the other women on the school board find deeply uncomfortable. And that's something striking, that when we first meet Alina, she has not only got a son in this private school, and we don't really know anything about her, but she is of a different nationality to the others as well. She has a son with a Mexican husband, and it's all kind of, you know, the other white mothers are a little bit, you know, that's already first like they're throwing their noses up at her almost, but also that she has a newborn baby and she breastfeeds at this meeting. And so straight away, that's telling you that she's quite forthright and that she doesn't really care what the others think about her. But she's going into a group where everybody knows everybody else's business. And I think they're a little bit, you know, they're a little bit shocked that they don't know anything about this young mother. But as I said, there is a connection between Grace and Alina, and she doesn't really know what it is. But Grace is actually the last person to see Alina at the fundraiser before things take a wobble the next day. So it's very much, you know, we start off in very much of a psychological thriller territory. And then eventually, I mean, for anyone who's seen the trailer for this, you know, 2 minutes will kind of give something away. It does verge into courtroom drama territory. But that's no shocker, given the fact that this is a David E. Kelly series and that, you know, he has found a lot of success, you know, in courtroom dramas.
Yes, and the wealth of the people in it is also key. Like all of these white women, again, in this fundraiser group for their private school, they're all lawyers or therapists.
They are, yes. And it's interesting because without going too much into the plot, The Undoing, it very much is kind of a prestige crime drama. It's dressed up as HBO's next prestige crime drama, following the footsteps of True Detective, following the footsteps of Sharp Objects by Gillian Flynn with Amy Adams, and also following Big Little Lies, which was another David E. Kelly series which we'll come back to. But it's also, you know, it also wants to be more than that, and it does raise themes of white privilege, of what it's like to live in New York City and try to Grace and Jonathan are presented as a couple who are almost, you know, these perfect suburbanites, but they're trying to live this life where they want to keep to themselves, but you're living in a city and you're living in a community of rich white privileged people that all know about one another. And when the court case begins, it also starts to kind of question how much, you know, a part that the media plays in these things. And again, I don't want to give too much away.
It asks a lot of questions, but it
never really digs any deeper. It just puts them out there, and it's up to the audience then to kind of follow them if they want to.
Okay, let's bring our listeners into the world so that they can get an idea of the various persona. Grace, played by Nicole Kidman, meets a very upset Alina, this is Matilda De Angelis, in the bathroom at a fundraiser for the private school both their schools attend. So these are the two women you talked about.
Are you okay? I'm sorry. Because sometimes I just feel overwhelmed and lost. Do you ever feel that?
If you ever want to talk for free, I apologize, no. I didn't mean it to sound like that. But if you do ever want to talk.
You're so kind. Thank you.
And please don't be intimidated. The parents at Reardon can be a little, But most of them are very kind. They are nice people, kind people.
But you are the most kind.
We'll see. Matilda De Angelis there plays Alina and Nicole Kidman plays Grace. That's from The Undoing. Chris Wasser is looking at the series. We can't talk any more really about the series, but let's talk about David E. Kelly, who has certainly carved out a niche for himself in the area of crime-focused series, hasn't he?
He really has, yes. And he's got quite an impressive CV, but it's probably his work in the last 5 years that I've been drawn to. And I love that how he's best known for, in the last couple of years, for adapting Stephen King's Mr. Mercedes crime novels. Nobody really knew that Stephen King would find, you know, this new level of success as a crime writer, and nobody expected it to turn into a damn fine series for HBO starring Brendan Gleeson. But what I like about that, and also what he did with Big Little Lies, which also starred Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon and Shailene Woodley was in there too, is he's not afraid to mix things up, and he's not afraid to rearrange the furniture and give you something that deviates from the source material, but that also provides something fresh for people who are so kind of familiar with the novel. And I know a lot of people might be fussy about those kinds of things, but I like when the story is told differently. But Kelly, he actually has a legal background, and when he was studying at Princeton and studying at Boston University back in the late 1980s, the plan was to become a lawyer, and he did exactly that. And he was dealing first of all in small crime. He was a small crime lawyer, but also dealing in real estate. And on the side, I don't know how he found the time, he was screenwriting, and it was just a hobby. He got involved in small theater groups. He got involved in some sketch comedy groups, and he wrote a whole screenplay for a film in the late 1980s. And that film was made with Judd Nelson, and he thought, look, I might be able to, and it was a crime comedy drama. He thought, look, I might actually follow this route. I might, this might actually be mm-hmm. my calling. So he went on to create some very successful TV shows, Doogie Howser, MD, Chicago Legal, Boston Practice. He most famously in the 90s, he also created Ally McBeal. And a lot of his writing, sometimes it's quite melodramatic, sometimes it's quite soapy, but he's been often commended for the fact that he does pay attention to what it's like in an American courtroom. And you might think that, this is all overblown and this is all just kind of, Aaron Sorkin kind of a territory for audiences. Everyone's just shouting at one another. But, he has been held up as quite an authentic writer when he places things into a courtroom. But I don't know about you, Kay. I watched Big Little Lies, and this is the series that I compare The Undoing to most. I've watched five episodes were given to me by HBO, and I should say that HBO were reluctant to give any press. Yes, they were actually reluctant to give press the final episode, because it does keep you guessing right up until the end, and we don't want to spoil anything. But I thought this was so like Big Little Lies, and I think it's more than Nicole Kidman. I think it's just getting into that formula now that HBO has in terms of what they're producing crime series wise.
Now, Big Little Lies was hugely successful. It was nominated, I think, for 16 Emmys in 2017.
It was, yes, and it really did deserve everything good that came its way. I thought the first series especially was just sensational. And again, you had Kelly taking a very well-known novel by Leanne Moriarty with a beginning, a middle, and end, which is always great. The second series kind of, went off the boil a little bit. But this novel, briefly, it just concerned five women in Monterey, California. And we know that there has been a murder in this town. But rather than tell you who has been murdered or who might be responsible, it plays out both the police testimonies alongside the incidents that led up to the murder. And along the way, you have accounts of domestic abuse in this small group of women. You have a rape case, which is, the worst kept secret in this town. You have all of these rich white privileged people's lives just falling apart, in behind the scenes, but they're presenting themselves as the perfect family to all of their friends, but nobody is who they say they are, and everyone is a suspect, and it keeps you guessing right up until the end. It's actually a marvelous whodunit in terms of the fact that it keeps you guessing who is actually going to die right up until the end. And I thought it was a beautiful story, and I think the most valuable player of this series, other than Alexander Skarsgård, who walked away with every award that he could get, was Nicole Kidman. And I think she is better suited to this long form storytelling, because she's very good at this stage in her career of, you don't normally see it in movie stars and actors at this stage of her career, that she wants to still prove something, that she's still trying to find characters that are incredibly uncomfortable to spend time with, but you're just drawn to them. And I think Kelly's material just brought the best out of Kidman, so it's no surprise that the two of them would work together again, as they have done on The Undoing.
Okay, well, let's hear a clip which brings together Grace and Jonathan, that's Hugh Grant and Nicole Kidman. Here they talk about wanting to move out of New York, and Grace is worried about raising their son there.
I don't know. Sometimes I think we should move out of the city. said, the most New York person I've ever met in my life.
No, but don't you worry sometimes that you're raising your son in a bubble?
I thought that was the whole essence of modern parenting, isn't it? Keep them protected from reality for as long as possible so that when they finally emerge, they can't cope and end up self-harming.
I thought we were doing really well at that.
Yeah. Wow. What about Schenectady, huh? I've heard nice things about Schenectady.
Well, it sounds horrible, even phonetically. So is this a serious conversation?
Yeah. Yep. Manhattan is a lonely place. I mean, when you think about it, we don't have a lot of close friends.
Well, it's only because we hate everyone.
You hate everyone. I don't.
I wouldn't call us isolated. Our days are stuffed with people and their problems. I mean, we're right up close with them at their most vulnerable. It's not a conventional social life, but in terms of meaningful human interaction, I would say we did very well. Mm. I don't like you being lonely. Mm. You lonely in there? Would you like some company? Would you like to be washed? Grace? Dr. Fraser with his magic hands.
God.
Shall I get my rubber glove?
Come on, come in.
I'm coming, Grace.
The very serious and the very naughty Hugh Grant all in one scene there with Nicole Kidman playing Grace. But don't be fooled, he's not that naughty fun Hugh Grant. Four Weddings and a Funeral is far behind him, isn't it, Chris?
It really is, yeah. And I should also say that I've always been a fan of Hugh Grant. He turned 60 there a few weeks back and he has been talking in interviews around The Gentleman, which he starred in earlier in the year, Guy Ritchie's comedy drama. He was by far the best thing in that disaster of a film, and also for The Undoing. And he's saying that he is beginning to enjoy acting now, because he gave some interviews around the time that he starred in Love Actually, around 16, 17 years ago, where he admitted that acting might not have been the best profession for him to fall into, because although he was very good at it, I think, you know, Four Weddings and a Funeral, About a Boy, Notting Hill, 2 weeks' Notice, you know, you think they're very, they're these kind of, you know, gimmicky romantic comedies, they're, you know, very lightweight. They're not really, because those kind of performances are very hard to master, and Hugh Grant made it look very easy, but it's not. And I think he was just fed up with playing the same character all the time. And it's magnificent then to see that in the last 5 years, whether through choice or whether it's just, you know, he's actually picking up, you know, the next screenplay that pops through the door rather than the romantic comedy one, he's transitioned into this wonderfully charismatic character actor, and that he's taking on roles that are, you know, it's almost as though he's a young performer stepping out of his Disney days and wants to prove that he's grown up and that he really can act. Because the roles we've seen him in, you know, in The Undoing, he's fabulous, because you do not know what to think of this man. And again, without giving anything away, you don't know whether he is quite playful, whether he is charming, or whether he is something nastier altogether. And that's, and to actually keep you guessing for 5 hours of television, that's a wonderful performance. It's wonderful writing, but it's wonderful performance. And alongside his roles in A Very English Scandal, where he played Jeremy Thorpe, and also playing a villain in the Paddington films, I think he is just at the beginning now of something special. I think he is experiencing something of a career renaissance. And I think The Undoing, again, is another shade. He's flexing muscles here that we've never seen from before. And he was the standout player for me in this show.
Yes, he is indeed. But getting back to David E. Kelly and The Undoing and Big Little Lies, you know, the class is an issue, as we've pointed to when we were describing both of the series. But it's not any great deep exploration of, I mean, they present class as in poor, that there's a, one of the characters is poorer than the kind of group of very wealthy, usually women. But it's very much a toe in the water in this area, isn't it?
It is. It really is. I mean, you know, it's almost as though Nancy Myers, who, you know, made The Holiday and all of these films where, you know, Father of the Bride, all of these films where these fabulously wealthy white people with, you know, first world problems, you know, just they run into some complications and you're sitting there thinking they're not really complications at all. And although this is a murder trial, and although it tries to, and although this series evolves into a murder trial and you are thinking, wow, these people are getting themselves into big problems, they have the money there to make things work. And although although it tries to question, you know, like show you that these that there might be more to it, and you know, there are questions raised about, you know, if they were, you know, if this was a person of color, mm-hmm. that he wouldn't be getting away, or the mm-hmm. person who's responsible for the murder yeah. might not be getting away with such things. It doesn't really explore anything beyond overheard news reports. So it's quite a soapy, melodramatic piece of work. I would have liked if it went further down the psychological thriller route, because it is confined by the fact that half of the story does take place in a courtroom drama, so it doesn't give us anything new there. But it's the performances that kept me on side.
Absolutely.
It is flawed, but Hugh Grant is the best he's been in a long time. And I also should say, Donald Sutherland shows up as Grace's father. He is brilliant.
He does
brilliant
indeed.
Here.
Yes, and I'm, I think, three episodes in, and I'm going to keep going. My thanks to Chris Wasser. The Undoing will air weekly on Sky Atlantic and Now TV from Monday, October the 26th. That's it for tonight's show. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. The researchers were Paula Shields and Liam Murphy, and the programme was produced by Sinead Egan.